Hello, this is Kathleen, and today, Tuesday, February 17th, I'll be reading to you from the Metro West Daily News. Salem End Road Housing Proposal Appeal Continued Until March 11th by Caroline Bunnell. The Framingham Board of Appeals has continued until March 11th, a hearing on whether a proposed housing development on Salem End Road qualifies for protection under the Dover Amendment. The 47-unit housing proposal at 356 to 358 Salem End Road is designed to provide staff housing for the New England Center for Children, NECC, a residential school serving children with autism. NECC is in Southborough, about 3 miles from the proposed housing site. Neighbors filed an appeal after City Building Commissioner Fred Bray determined on November 25th that the project qualifies for protection under the Dover Amendment, a state law that exempts educational and religious uses from local zoning restrictions, though municipalities may regulate dimensional aspects such as size. After hearing arguments from representatives of both sides during its meeting on Wednesday, February 11th, the board voted to continue the matter to March 11th. To allow it time to review additional information, including a lease agreement between the property owner and NECC. Besides the 47-unit multifamily residential structure, the proposal calls for 103 parking spaces and an office building on the property zoned for R4, or single-family homes. The four-acre property, previously owned by Pure Life Development, LLC, was sold for $1 to the Delaware-registered Health Education Charitable Foundation, according to a December 22nd filing with the Middlesex Registry of Deeds. Two direct abutters, David Abramson and Joseph Bonanno, filed the appeal through their attorney, Neil Glick, who argued the project does not qualify for Dover protection because it is not an educational use. You have a for-profit developer that owns the land. Then you have a school in another municipality that seeks to use the land, not for any educational purpose, but simply, and this is what they wrote, as a standalone staff housing so it can pay its staff less and thus pad its bottom line, Glick said during the February 11th ZBA meeting. It is difficult to imagine a project less qualified for Dover Amendment purpose protection. The attorney said the only connection between the property and NECC is a lease agreement, which he said has not been filed with the city. Without that lease, there is no educational use tying the project to Dover Amendment protections, he said. My client will be stuck with a huge multifamily for-profit development sitting practically in their backyard with even less connection, Glick said. David McKell, the attorney representing Health Education Charitable Foundation, Inc., the current property owner, said it has entered into a 20-year lease with NECC that includes 2 5-year extension options. He told the board that occupancy would be limited to NECC employees who must sign license agreements requiring them to vacate their units within 2 days if their employment ends. Mikkel argued that the housing is directly connected to the school's educational mission and staffing requirements qualifying it for Dover Amendment protection. He added that if the lease expires and no qualifying educational use continues, the building would be removed. NECC Chief Financial Officer Michael Downey told the ZBA that staff housing is essential to the school's operation. We would like to avoid offering housing, but we would not be able to staff our program without it, he said during the February 11th meeting. Several neighbors challenged the Dover determination during the hearing and requested that the decision be overturned. One resident, Brenda Steinberg, said residents have not seen evidence that the property owner is a nonprofit, a requirement of the Dover Amendment. Housing staff is not a relevant use, she said. I'm sorry to NECC that that's what they need this land for, but that's not an educational use. Their inability to attract staff is not a good reason to approve a Dover application. Another resident, Rachel O'Leary, said land courts have repeatedly distinguished between housing for students versus staff. Courts have drawn the distinction between student housing, which can be integral to an educational mission, and faculty or staff housing, which is not, she said. Housing for teachers has been treated as residential use, even when sponsored by schools, because it does not itself provide instruction or education. ZBA Chair Stephen Meltzer said that to make an informed decision, the board needs to review the lease agreement. Board member Leonard Levy requested documentation confirming that Health Education Charitable Foundation is a nonprofit. The board unanimously voted to continue the hearing on March 11th to give proponents time to provide the requested information and allow the board to further review materials. Sudbury State Representative Carmine Gentile will not seek re-election by Caroline Bunnell. Saying it's time to pass the baton, State Representative Carmine Gentile, Democrat from Sudbury, has announced that he will not seek a seventh term representing the 13th Middlesex District. I have enjoyed representing the people of the 13th Middlesex District these past 11 years and look forward to the finish in January of 2027, he said in a statement on X, formerly Twitter. This year continues to provide challenges and great satisfaction. Besides all of the Sudbury, the 13th Middlesex District includes parts of Wayland, Precincts 1 and 4, Marlborough, Ward 1, Precincts 1 and 2, Ward 2, Precinct 2A, and Ward 7, Precinct 2A, Lincoln, Precinct 1, and Concord, Precincts 2, 3, and 4. Gentile was first elected to the House in November 2014. He succeeded fellow Democrat Tom Conroy, who left for what turned out to be an unsuccessful run for state treasurer. The district has been dependably liberal. In his most recent re-election in November 2024, Gentile earned nearly three times as many votes, 16,459 to 5,901, as his Republican challenger, Virginia Gardner. 2 years earlier, he faced no GOP opposition. State Senator Jamie Eldridge, Democrat from Marlborough, praised Gentile in a recent Facebook post. Throughout our time serving in the legislature and representing Marlborough, Sudbury, and Wayland together, Carmine has been a great friend, a strong progressive legislator, and an extremely generous person who has championed helping senior and people with disabilities, protecting the environment, supporting civil rights, fighting for criminal justice reform, including visiting prisons and advocating for public higher education, Eldridge posted. In an email to the Daily News, Gentile cited family considerations, including wanting to spend more time with his wife, children, and grandchildren, as key to his decision not to run again. He also said that he hopes to become more involved in national politics. Our country's flawed democracy is under a vigorous autocratic assault, which continues to damage the health and the welfare of the majority of Americans, especially those of color, he wrote in his last email. I hope to be able to spend time in 2027 and beyond shoring up democracy in other states and Washington, D.C. Gentile also voiced support for his legislative aide, Ravi Simon, who recently announced his campaign for the 13th Middlesex District seat. Gentile said Simon understands the district well and has been a strong mentor to newer staff. Reflecting on his 11 years in office, Gentile said he's proud of securing resources and funding for his constituents, including support for housing, food, medical care, and transportation. He also highlighted his role in passing comprehensive criminal justice reform aimed at reducing crime rates and recidivism. Another key accomplishment was the expansion of free higher education at the state's 15 community colleges, adding that he hopes the state's universities and UMass campuses will do the same. Gentile said he planned to remain involved in public service at both the local and national levels. He chairs the Sudbury Housing Trust and is a member of the town's Council on Aging, while continuing advocacy work both regionally and nationally. I have prided myself on being accessible and responsible to constituents and believe we are all better for it, he wrote in his email. The past 11 years have been greatly rewarding for me, and I am thankful for my family's forbearance and support. I am grateful for the confidence which voters demonstrated in electing me in 12 primary and general elections. Is Waymo Massachusetts bound? State legislators push for autonomous vehicle legislation. By Margie McCullen from USA Today Network. Waymo, a self-driving car company, wants to come to Boston, and some state legislators are pushing for autonomous vehicles to operate all over Massachusetts. On February 5th, Waymo announced that they are planning to return to Boston after a stint in 2025 to continue effectively adapting to Boston's cobblestones, narrow alleyways, runabouts, and turnpikes. But the company said that they need the state to legalize fully autonomous vehicles before Bostonians will be able to use their cars fully human-free. According to the National Conference of State Legislatures, more than half of the states have enacted some kind of legislation related to autonomous vehicles. Massachusetts is not one of them. Massachusetts companies that want to operate self-driving cars on public roads must fill out an application package with the Massachusetts Department of Transportation. As of February 9th, Waymo had not yet done it so, a spokesperson for the department said. But now lawmakers in the state are working clear to way for self-driving cars, not just in Boston, but across the state. Senator William Driscoll, Democrat from Milton, has filed a bill, Senate 2379, that would allow the use of autonomous vehicles on state highways as long as they meet certain requirements. Autonomous vehicles are here and more are on the way, Driscoll said in a statement to the Worcester Telegram. Massachusetts needs to have a clear and consistent policy for them. The legislation filed starts that conversation. The bill has a corresponding House bill, House 3634, sponsored by Representative Dan Cahill, Democrat from Lynn, and Representative Natalie Blaze, Democrat from Deerfield. The bills would create a regulatory framework for autonomous vehicles to operate in the state, including directing the Department of Transportation to create and issue licenses for operating self-driving cars. The bills stipulate that a self-driving car must meet certain conditions to drive on state highways. It must be able to give control to the human passenger in case of a failure of the automated driving system. And if there is a failure, the vehicle must only achieve a minimal risk condition. The vehicle must also be capable of operating in compliance with the applicable traffic and car safety laws of the state. Those who want to operate fully autonomous vehicles without human drivers must submit proof that the car is covered by insurance. The minimum amount of liability coverage for death, bodily injury, and property damage must be $1 million, the bills say. The Department of Transportation, the Department of Safety, and the local police department must also be given a law enforcement interaction plan so that they can safely remove the vehicle from the highway or address other public safety risks. Fully autonomous vehicles that are 10,000 pounds or more would be required to have a human driver under the bills. The lawmakers supporting these efforts see self-driving cars as an inevitability, and some local business leaders worry that Massachusetts is falling behind in the world of mobility technology. But the bills are facing pushback from labor unions, who see that efforts as an unchecked expansion of autonomous vehicles that would threaten their jobs and public safety. Driverless cars and trucks pose a serious threat to public safety, our communities, and the livelihoods of the countless dedicated men and women across the Commonwealth who work as professional drivers, said Tom Murray, president of Teamsters Local 25, in a statement. These machines don't benefit working people. They only serve the interests of out-of-state big tech billionaires, and their opinions shouldn't outweigh the needs of Massachusetts residents. They are supporting a different set of bills, Senate 2393 and House 3669, which would require human operators to be present in all self-driving cars. Others, wary of Waymo and self-driving cars, have also brought up safety concerns. Waymo in December recalled thousands of vehicles after a glitch in the software caused the cars to drive past stopped school buses. And some cars have crashed into objects and even people. My focus is on safety and practical ways forward, Driscoll said. My hope is that conversations continue to be thoughtful and productive as we explore the pros and the cons of AVs in the Commonwealth. Area Dems plan March 1st caucus to pick convention delegates, by Beth McDermott, AI-assisted reporter from USA Today. The Framingham Democratic Committee will caucus on Sunday, March 1st, to elect 34 delegates and 6 alternates to send the 2026 State Democratic Convention this spring, according to a community announcement. The March 1st Framingham Democratic Caucus will be held in the Costin Room at the Framingham Public Library, 49 Lexington Street. Democrats can register for the caucus when doors open at 1 p.m. Registration closes at 1:45 p.m. Registered and pre-registered Democrats in Framingham, aged 16 or older by March 29th, can vote and be elected as delegates or alternates, according to the announcement. Registration forms will be available at the door for those who wish to register as delegates or as Democrats on the day of the caucus. Youth aged 16 to 35, individuals with disabilities, people of color, veterans, and members of the LGBTQ plus community who are not elected as delegates or alternates are encouraged to apply to be add-on delegates at the caucus by visiting https://www.massdems.org/caucus-and-convention. The 2026 Massachusetts Democratic Convention will be held from May 29th to the 30th at the DCU Center in Worcester, according to the announcement. Those interested in learning more about the Framingham Democratic Committee or getting involved can contact Stephanie Dealey at SDEELEY01701@gmail.com or call 508-843-4333. The committee holds regular monthly meetings at 7 p.m. on the third Monday of the month at Loring Arena. More information is available at www.framinghamdems.org. Wayland Venue to Host National Curling Event for Women by Beth McDermott, AI-assisted reporter from USA Today. Broomstones Curling Club in Wayland is hosting the 77th National Women's Bondspiel on February 19th to the 22nd, according to the community announcement. Competitors from throughout the country, representing 28 clubs, will compete over 4 days in an event sponsored by the United States Women's Curling Association, with games scheduled Friday and Saturday, culminating in finals on Sunday, February 22nd, according to the announcement. An opening ceremony is planned for 7 p.m. on Wednesday, February 18th. Invited guests include Wayland Select Board Chair Carol Martin, State Representative Carmine Gentile, Democrat from Sudbury, United States Women's Curling Association President Ann Kirkpatrick, and Rich Collier, President of Broomstones Curling Club. The public is welcome to attend and watch the games in person, according to the announcement. For those who prefer to watch from home, games will be streamed online. For more information, including team details and the event schedule, can be found by visiting https://sites.google.com/broomstones.org/2026-USWCA-nationals/home. For those interested in trying curling, Broomstones is hosting an Olympic open house later this year, according to the announcement. The club also offers limited ice rental opportunities for private groups throughout the season, subject to availability. Further details are available at broomstones.com. For most of the country, bitter cold likely ending, by Doyle Rice, USA Today. Folks in the central and eastern United States who've endured weeks of bitter cold and snow are wondering, is winter over? Will the polar vortex come back? Are we safe from the worst of winter's wrath? Experts have some good news. The most intense cold of the winter is largely behind the eastern and central states, AccuWeather lead long-range meteorologist Paul Pastalock said in an online forecast on February 11th. Forecasters say there is no sign of any intrusions of Arctic air across the central or eastern United States for the next couple of weeks. In fact, no additional outbreaks of severe to extreme cold are expected for the rest of the winter, according to AccuWeather long-range experts. Weather trader meteorologist Ryan Maui has good news. Heading into the final week of February, the main polar vortex cold pool reservoir remains largely locked up over Canada north of the Arctic Circle, Maui said in an email to USA Today. It really looks like we're turning the corner on winter into the home stretch, he added February 11th on X. However, some experts urge caution in throwing dirt on the winter. Polar expert Judah Cohen of MIT said in his blog on February 9th, the upcoming predicted pattern flip of cold western U.S. and mild eastern U.S. is not permanent, in my opinion. I expect in late February or early March the pattern to resort to the dominant pattern of the winter. Mild western U.S. and cold eastern U.S., even if briefly. He said this would be consistent with a stretched polar vortex, though it remains weak overall. A weak or a stretched polar vortex is bad news for winter weather haters in the United States. Folks rooting for spring want a strong polar vortex that's bottled up over the Arctic. Additionally, though, Cohen said even if the cold returns in March, it is important to keep in mind cold in March is very different from cold in January, and snows become increasingly elevation dependent. Pastalock said in an email to USA Today also cautioned that the vortex may stretch again next month, perhaps pushing some colder air from western Canada to the eastern U.S. in a week or two or three of March. But he added this is very late for a disruption and the impacts again may be minimal. Despite the warm-up, it doesn't mean winter is entirely over, Pastalock said. New risks will arise due to the warm-up as colder, stormier conditions shift to the west, he said. In addition, the persistent cold has caused a significant buildup of ice on streams, rivers, and bays across the northeast and midwest, AccuWeather said. With any thaw after an extended period of frigid conditions and buildup of ice, the potential for ice jams and ice jam flooding will increase on non-tidal portions of the streams and the rivers. Rising temperatures will melt snow and ice over the next few weeks, which can trigger ice jams and river flooding earlier than usual, especially along the Mississippi and Ohio rivers, Pastalock said. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you all have a safe and well day.